Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app.
This is Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Tuesdays and Thursdays from 10 a.m.
Well, good morning, everyone. We're truly blessed. We're in our studio. We've got Dave there. And by the way, if you doubt Dave, that was his voice doing the stinger for me. It's Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. We've got an exciting news for you because we're going to have our gardening guru on, Wally Richards, and we're going to try and open up the phone lines. No, we're not going to try and do it. Dave's going to do it. So you can ring in and directly ask our gardening guru, Wally, questions. We're going to cover off a bit of stuff with him first because it's been a long time, but we're going to have it that you can dial in and ask Wally gardening questions. I've also got an interview with a health guru, Sarah Farrant. It's a pre-record, so we won't be able to ring in. We're going to talk her into coming on live, but she's a bit nervous, so we've got to be gentle with her when she comes on. But let's start. Let's get straight in. And we'll bring Wally on. Good morning, Wally.
Good morning, good morning. You know, the biggest disadvantage of this is I can't see you. I can't watch your facial expressions I drop a little bit of info out or something. Yeah. We're radio without pictures.
We're radio without pictures. Wally, it's been too long.
It has, yeah. I've missed you. And so has many, many people. And I've had people ringing me up and saying, "Where's that Rodney? Why don't you get him back and get him on the air?" Well, my God!
Well,
you're more popular than me.
No, I was away, and then we had technical issues. But anyway, we're here now. We've got a lot to cover because it's spring has sprung, right?
Oh, it's what? I had a farmer the other day. He was complaining his grass is growing so fast the cattle can't keep up with it.
Really? Is it a good season?
It is. Well, he thinks it's going to be a marvellous season. And I said, "Drew, you'll be out haymaking." And he said, "Oh, my God, I'll be haymaking for sure." And, yeah, I've had the same thing from a number of gardeners too. And I know in my own, you know, patch, stuff's growing, particularly the weeds. My God, they're always keen to get their heads up and away and problems this time of the year, keeping them in control.
Now, Wally, we're going to cover off tomatoes, the number one crop after roses. We're going to cover off potatoes. And we're going to cover off dealing with weeds without Roundup.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
Where do you want to start?
Well, I suppose let's start with the potatoes. That's down to earth.
Yes.
Now, ideally, most good gardeners already know how to plant potatoes, etc., whether it be in a bucket or in the ground. But in the open ground, remember in the old days, we used to, when we bought a new section and before we put the house on it, we would plant the whole thing up in potatoes.
Mm-hmm. I do.
Why did we do that?
Because it broke up the soil.
Yes, it did. They're marvellous for that. So any old patch of soil around the place that you've got, raced area and so forth, ideally you make a trench probably about 20 centimetres deep, and you place your seed potato. Now, it can be even one that you've got from the supermarket, as long as it's got some eyes, and ideally before you plant them, you should have them out in a bright light situation outside, like under a carport or somewhere, where they get good light and those eyes green up, right? That makes them hard. Otherwise, if it's in the cupboard, of course, they become long white things, which really is a bit useless because tendency they'll break off and they won't produce a good result. So, underneath each potato in this trench, about 20 centimetres deep, we're going to place a few sheep manure pellets, ideally a teaspoon of gypsum and a teaspoon of
Just back
of
the
bio.
Truck up there, Wally. You say sheep manure.
Pellets, yeah.
Does it have to be? Could it be poultry or a horse?
Oh, yeah, you can use poultry. It's just that a lot of people, unlike yourself, having chooks, don't have them.
Okay.
And as a result of that, they have to rely on what they can get from the garden centre.
Got it.
So sheep manure, pellets, blood and bone, they're easy. So those two things go under.
How much would you put in per potato?
I say a small handful. So you're talking about probably 5 or 6 pellets.
Okay.
If you're using chook manure, I would put in probably a good tablespoon or so, a small handful, that sort of thing. The biofoss helps with the rooting up and the formation of the potatoes. And you can, if you've had trouble in the past, put some neem powder there as well. The neem powder will help with any soil insects that might burrow into the tubers later on.
And your gypsum, what's the gypsum for?
The gypsum is calcium and sulfur, and that really makes a good difference to the quality of the taste and so forth. The calcium is important, and because it's gypsum, it's pH neutral, so it doesn't make the soil alkaline. If your soil is alkaline, like you've limed it with garden lime, then the tendency is your potatoes will have what we call potato scab. Mm. And potato scab is basically caused by the soil alkalinity. So, okay, we've got our little pile.
Now, I've still
there.
Got questions, Wally, because I'm stupid, remember?
Okay.
You put the manure and the gypsum under the potato.
Yep.
Okay, got it.
Yep, just in one spot. You don't have to do the whole trench, that's a waste of time. I'm Scottish in my gardening. Like, I'll make a planting hole and I'll put the goodies in the planting hole rather than scatter them over the whole area to feed the weeds, which is all very nice for the weeds, but it's better to feed directly to the plant. So we've got this little pile there and maybe a little bit of soil just over the top of it, just a fine layer, so it's sitting on the soil and the roots will go down into all the goodies. Now we're going to cover it over and just cover it. So the little shoots are covered, right? And they should be pointing upwards as well as you can have it. And we watch them and check them every day or so. And as soon as we see some green foliage coming through the soil, we cover them again. Once again, just cover them so they're just covered. What we're trying to do as the plant's growing is stretch the home. So the longer we have that, the more potatoes we'll get, right? The key to it is, if you let the top get up, say, I'll go back to inches, I know them, 2 or 3 inches tall, you waste your time. You could cover it till the cows come home, but you'll never get any more potatoes. It's got to be covered as soon as they come through. And if there's any late frosts, of course, they're protected as well. So that's good value. Okay, so we get right
up to the
soil level.
I have a question, Wally.
Yep.
I'm a person that thinks that if 1 teaspoon's good, a tablespoon's even better. So when I buried my potatoes last year, I put them down like 30 centimetres, right, thinking I'd get a whole lot more potatoes. Do you know what the net result of that was?
No.
I had to dig really deep to find my potatoes.
You had to what, sorry?
Dig really deep to get my potatoes.
Yeah, well...
20 centimetres is going to be this year.
20 centimetres, yeah. No, that's fair enough, because you're going to mound. Once you get that surface level, then you start mounding up the sides as well to keep them covered until you get a mound that's probably... Let's go to the centimetres of my ruler, about 15 centimetres tall or so, you know. Mm. And then you let the tops go. And the tops will gather energy from the sun, and away it will go. It depends on whether you plant an early variety or a late variety depends on how long it takes before they're ready to harvest. Like, you've got Swift, which is around about 60-odd days or so. Your early potatoes, I can't think of one off the top of my head, they're about 90 days. And then you've got your main crop, or your late potatoes, which is like Rua, and you're talking 120 days for them, right? And that's an indication. It's not 100% correct. What you can always do when your potatoes are been in the ground for a while and they look like they're going to be ready soon, you can put your finger into the soil and feel for a potato and pull it out, right?
Mm.
This is a Scottish expression. I think it's grotting or something. Have you heard that expression?
Nope.
Where you can pop over the neighbours at night and put your finger into the soil and take a few potatoes home for next day. It's kind of stealing them out. Okay, so we've got our potatoes up. We did run the plants up, and yes, we've got a nice crop of good-sized potatoes underneath. And the potatoes, when we cut them open, they're clean and creamy or coloured. There's no rings inside. Right, okay. Your problem is psyllids. If you're in an area where you've had psyllids in the past and or the area has psyllids, chances are they will attack your plants. Now, psyllids is an interesting little insect. It's very hard to see. The nymphs under on the foliage, you need a looking glass, a magnifying glass, to be able to see them. The adults are like a little wee midgey fly. Once again, usually not recognised. What happens if they attack the plants in the early stages? When you harvest your crop, you'll only have potatoes the size of a marble, and they will be reshooting. Right? Waste of time. Whole thing's history. If they attack the plants in the later stages, then the tubers will be a good size, but they'll have dark rings inside them and they will taste horrible. And once again, a waste of time. So if there's psyllid problems, we will talk more about this with tomatoes because they have psyllid problems. The best thing to do is get your potatoes in really early, like in June, and because of your trenching method, you're keeping them protected against frost, and you're going to harvest well before Labor Weekend, right? Planting from Labor Weekend or from now on, if there's psyllids around, you possibly have a problem, right? So that's the story. Oh, one other thing too. People have, in the past, in regards to psyllid, they have harvested a plant or two. Potatoes are perfect, good size, clean, and so forth. They've left the plants in the ground, which you can do, no trouble at all. Then the psyllid has come along. And when they feed on the plant, they inject a toxin into the plant. And that plant, that toxin goes down and affects the tubers underneath, either in their size or the rings. So they've left the tops on and come back a couple of weeks later to harvest another lot of potatoes for the table, and hello, lo and behold, I've got the rings. So if you're going to leave potatoes in the ground, which you can do, they're quite safe there, is cut the tops off, cover the stubble over with a bit of soil, and just leave them there sitting till you're ready to dig them up.
Wally, is that potatoes done and we're on to tomatoes?
Tomatoes...
No, before you go into tomatoes, because we've got a text done with the question, but it's unrelated. I didn't want to interrupt you.
Okay, right. Okay, do you have the question now?
Yeah, my question for Wally is this. Serious ant problem. I deal with nests from in the house, then everywhere I go to plant, there's an ant's nest in the soil and in plant pots, just everywhere.
Right.
Do they damage plant roots?
Yes, they can do. They can upset things, particularly in containers, because they're making more and more room and less room for the roots. I don't think they feed on the roots themselves or use that. If the roots start to rot, they might use that. But they take more and more room for their colony as it builds, and in containers, a problem. We have a solution which is the oldest ant bait known to New Zealanders, and it's, we called it Granny Min's ant bait after my mother.
What's it called? Say it again slowly.
Granny Min's ant bait.
Granny Min's. How do you spell Min's?
M-I-N.
Okay.
Min as in a name.
Yep.
My mother's name was Min, or it was actually Willa Minor, and everybody called her Min. Now, we have that in a little jar, and it retails only for about $8. What it is a combination of boric acid and borax, in which you add the water, the sugar, and a bit of honey to that, and make up a very potent ant bait, which the ants never learn what's killing them. They come and take it because of the sweetness. They take it back to their nest. They feed it into the young, etc., etc., and you can wipe out the nest over a period of time. Most effective and real cheap to do, right?
Okay.
In comparison.
Okay, so, sorry?
The problem with a lot of ant baits is they become bait shy after a period of time. They recognise what's killing them and, hello, no good to go, and they stop taking the bait. If you have cats, dogs, or so forth, and you're concerned, normally what you do is you make the bait up, and you get some jar lids, put them outside where the ant trails are, where the ant activity is, and you put the liquid into the lids and let them go for it. If you have cats or dogs or anything you're worried about, then you put it inside a jar on its side, a little Marmite jar, something like that, and put the liquid inside that and let the ants go for it. Now, if they're coming inside, the most effective thing I've found is those cans you hang on the wall that go every minute or so, which dull out pyrethrum. Now, ants can sense the pyrethrum, and they will not enter that room while that can is operating, and for a reasonable period of time after, and then they'll start to come back in. So inside the house, that's the way to go. Hang one of those things. You get them from supermarkets or hardware shops, wherever. But outside, use the ant bait, and do not use the ant bait inside because it only brings them inside, and you don't want them in bloody things inside.
What happens if the ants are already inside? Does the pyrethrum still drive them out?
Yep, yep, and you can use fly spray, of course, as well. Okay. That's either pyrethrum or permethrum. Permethrum is man-made pyrethrum, so it's a chemical one of the same thing, basically. And, yeah.
Tell us your webpage where we can get that. What is it? Granny Min's Ant Bait.
Yep. That's www.0800-466-464.co.nz. It's our new website. My God, we've got this beautiful website up that you can use your smartphones on now, where the old one you couldn't, not easily anyway. And, all our products are there, and what people do is they go through and they pick out what they want and register, of course, and then submit the order. I get the order by email. I phone the people and have a chat to them about the order. It's called service. I know it's strange, but, well, we're just old-fashioned that way. And, of course, we sort out any shipping costs. And motor payment, they can do credit card, debit card over the phone, or arrange a bank transfer. And then we send off the goods, and any time they've got a question, they can always ring me.
Okay.
How about that?
That is service. Now, what's the webpage again?
It's www.0800-466-464.co.nz. Same as our phone number. When we did that, the IT people say, you can't do that. And I said, why? Well, nobody's ever done it. I know. That's why I'm doing it. Yeah, it makes sense. You know, the silly one where you have the name of your company in as your telephone number?
Yeah.
30800 or something or other. You know, and you spend all day looking at the keys going, now, which is K? Oh, that's number 5. My God. But 0800-466-464, you can talk to me or you can order on our mail order website.
Oh, wow. I've just gone onto your webpage, Wally. It looks very, very flash.
Yeah, it is.
Have you gone corporate?
Yeah. There's me and my partner and her son and his girlfriend. Yeah, we're corporate.
I think Reality Check Radio listeners have been good to you. Oh, it looks beautiful. Oh, man, because it did look a bit, what would we say, old.
Mm. Well, the wheels were falling off, and something I didn't realise in IT, that things do go wrong. I thought they were perfect, you know, forever. And no, it was funny things were happening on the site, and it was what we'd call an antique, I suppose, in IT terms. Mm. It was designed for desktop or laptop computers only.
And,
of course, in those days, that's all we had when I started the site off.
Okay, Wally, I've got another question before we get on to tomatoes. And the question is, sorry for another interruption. Oh, same texter. Does the borax and other ingredients affect soil or plants being a poison?
Yes. Borax, it becomes used in the soil for the boron aspect of it, creates boron toxicity. So, hence, you're putting it in lids. You're not applying it directly to the soil. There are other proprietary products. We've got Exudant and so forth, which we don't make up, but we get it from an importer, supplier, and we have them there. They can be used safely on the soil or whatever, or relatively safely on the soil, put it that way.
Got it. Tomatoes, Wally?
Yeah, tomatoes, right. One of my favourite crops, and I have been trying for the last 3 weeks to get out there and plant the damn things in my glasshouse. The problem being, of course, is I've been so busy with everything else, and every day I say to myself, I must get out there and plant my tomatoes. Now, I have a thing we talked about once before. Remember, it's called, what's the name, pots. The self-watering pots runoff.
Oh,
like
yes.
Like hydroponics. Yeah. Can't think. Autopots. Autopots are called, right? You have a pot with a sitting in a tray of its own size, and alongside in that same part is a little mechanical valve which opens and floods the tray and then closes off and stays closed until all the moisture's gone, then opens up and lets another light come in. So it's kind of like hydroponics without recirculating the liquid or the nutrients, right? You have a container, a bin or whatever, which you put the solution in. That's piped off to the valves, and away you go. Now, it's a marvellous system, and particularly for people with glass houses, because it's not quite so appropriate outdoors because it gets rained on and you lose some of the effect. But in a glass house, yeah, marvellous. You can grow beautiful capsicums, the same as they have in the supermarket, easily. Plants grow well because you're using a nutrient which is the same as hydroponics, right? So, good. The only problem I found with the system is it tends to have problems, like valves don't work, and they have to be cleaned, slugs get into them and make them inoperable until you get rid of the slugs. You lose nutrients sometimes because they overflow, and you waste. And the nutrient is not cheap, for sure, even though it's very good. So this year I've decided to use my auto pot system as a watering system only. And I'm going to put nutrients in, like Wally's Secret Tomato Food, in the containers when I plant the tomatoes up and on top of the containers, etc. And I will fill the tanks up with nice, clean, filtered water so there's no chlorine in it. And if something goes wrong and I lose some water, whoop-de-doo. Doesn't matter, yes. Does it? It hasn't cost you anything, really.
Do you sell the auto pots?
I used to, but you can go to any hydroponic outfit. They have them. Eden Glasshouses, I believe they have them. The new systems or the later models, I've got a bigger tubes on them, so there's less chance of blocking up. They work a little bit better. But as a self-watering system, I think it will be marvellous, and I'm looking really forward to using it in that manner rather than buying the more expensive food, per se. The key to growing tomatoes...
Before you go, I've got another question.
Yeah.
Hi, Rodney and Wally. Love your shows. I'm glad to have you back. Have a problem with snails and slugs in the greenhouse. They love eating my seedlings. I've tried salt on the floor of the greenhouse and extra trays under the seedlings to make it hard for them. Seed trays. Thanks, Darren. Keep up the good work. Slugs and snails in the glasshouse.
Right. Okay. There's a couple of things you can do. First of all, slugs and snails can walk over a razor blade and not injure themselves. So the idea of putting sharp little things around, diatomaceous earth and so forth, really, doesn't work, because they will just keep coming. It's pretty hard. I did have one time in my collection of things, things that you could put over seedlings, which was kind of an inverted cup, which they had to go up inside and then they have to go down and then back up. It tended to reduce the problem. The problem with slug baits is like the ordinary slug slam, menzol, I think is the name of another one. They were poisonous to hedgehogs and other animals and so forth. So not a good thing to have. The idea really for a safe bait is you have one called quash. Quash is a iron base bait which has got the attractant. It doesn't matter if the dog eats some of them, whoop-de-doo. It's only iron, like it's an iron tablet. But iron is deadly on slugs and snails, so when they consume some of that, they die. You can make that up yourself if you think about it, because all it is really bran, iron sulfate or chelated iron, and yeast. Yeast is the attractant, the bran is the holder, and of course what you've done is you've dissolved your sulfate of iron in water and then applied it to the bran so it's impregnated, and then you've added your yeast in, and you can put that out in lids or whatever, and it's the yeast that attracts them. Just like the old idea of wasting your beer by putting it in a saucer outside so that they're attracted to the dish of beer and they drown drunk and happy. The other one too... Which
and you can get iron sulfate just from Mitre 10 or anyone. It's cheap as chips, right?
Yeah. The little health packs of that. It's used to acidify the soil. It gets in... They use it in big quantities for putting on the lawn to... what do they do? Oh, that's for moss on the lawn, which really is a waste of time because it only burns the moss and the moss comes back afterwards. You're better to use our Wally's Wally's moss and liverwort control. That gets rid of it without it coming back for a while. So
It's okay, bran, iron sulfate, and yeast.
Yeast, yep. Any yeast, you know, that you use for baking, whatever. And there's your bait. So have that operating. The other one is copper. If you spray the plant, or what's name was, you could use Wally's liquid copper, nice blue copper sulfate. If on the ground you put some untreated sawdust and spray that, you could use rain guard with it so it doesn't wash off. But they cannot go over copper. In fact, in days gone by, people used to say, oh, well, you put down copper wire and around your plants and they won't go over it. And that works for a while, but the oxidisation in the air, of course, the copper oxidises and it loses that nice copper, what's name, and hence the snails can or slugs can go over it. Another one, which is very effective, and it can be used for slaters, slugs, earwigs, all those, is on your soil, you lay down a sheet of three-ply, say, once again, let's do the inches, say about 6 or 8 inches long and about 3 or 4 inches wide, and you lay that on the soil. Now, during the day, insects will hide under that because it's safe against birds, etc., right? So during the day, you go out and you fold back the what's name, and you find some slugs or earwigs or whatever underneath there, and you have made up in a little trigger sprayer. It could be pyrethrum, or you could use something like a janola and water, half and half, that sort of thing. And you spray them with that and lay it back down again. And that will control, over a period of time, untold pesties that are having a problem with slugs, snails, or whatever. With slugs and snails, if that's a problem, I'd spray them with copper because they can't handle that. And also, if you pull back shrubs and so forth on a fence, you'll find a whole lot of snails hiding behind on the fence. Or on some plants, you get those little wee snails up into the plant and causing some damage. Just spray with copper. Simple as that.
There you go.
In fact, copper is good for another insect too, problem. You know about the cherry slug or the pear slug?
Nope.
It's a little black slug that feeds on the leaves of your cherry, peach, pear, those two trees, not avocado, but nashi pears, the nashi pears. A little black slug makes holes in the leaves, and they will come out very soon and start working on the foliage once the trees have greened up. The first infestation is minor. They will cause a bit of damage and so forth, but then they will go off and pupate and so forth and come back and lay eggs. And your second generation, which is usually somewhere about December, January, February, that will be massive. And that will cause a lot of damage to the foliage on those trees. But once again, they cannot handle copper. So the first sign of some holes in the new leaves of your cherry, pear, whatever, get your copper out. Using Wally's liquid copper is ideal because it doesn't block the jets. I hated the old days when you used to have powdered copper oxychloride or copper hydroxide, and you mix the powder with water, and then you spend the rest of the day cleaning your bloody jets because you never got it right and they never all dissolved. But the liquid copper doesn't do that. So that's good value. And another thing, too, talking about copper, Yates many years ago said, well, when you go your copper sprays, you should add conker oil to the spray. And the idea there, you did two sprays at once at the same time rather than individually. Now, the conker oil was only there to smother, scale, or take care of thrips and so forth. And if you didn't have those problems, you're wasting your time and money. Now, the problem was, as I found out once upon a time, when I had bladder plum on a plum tree. Now, that's when the fruit, when it forms, doesn't go round, it goes into the shape like a bladder, right? And the idea then is to spray the tree at the time which is in flower and the early formation of the fruit with copper. And, of course, I was using, because I got sucked in to the scam, I was using oil with it. And every year I do that diligently and I still have a reasonable amount of bladder plum. One Sunday, I found I didn't have any conker oil. So couldn't be bothered going down to the garden centre and buying some. So instead, I just used copper. Perfect. It was the first year I had no bladder plum. What happens is the oil interreacts with the copper and reduces the effectiveness of the copper. Waste of time. So don't do that, listeners. It's not worth it. Okay, so where are we up to now?
We're on to tomatoes, but let me just say we're talking to Wally Richards, our gardening guru. We've got, you can text in 2057, and when we've got through, we'll open the lines, and we do want someone to call. The first caller will be special. And the call number when we get through is 0800 2057 57, but we're going to do now tomatoes.
Right. And the other thing, of course, Rodney, if I get a question that I can't answer, it'll be your turn.
Yes. Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah. I'm an ex-politician, so I can answer any question. It just won't be right or truthful.
Oh, no. It'll be
it'll
such
sound
a manner
good.
That nobody... It'll sound good, but it won't mean anything.
And it'll be safe and effective.
Yes, true, for sure. Okay, tomatoes. Now, tomatoes, implanting tomatoes, because they're related to potatoes, the deeper you plant them, the more roots they will make. And you'll notice that when a tomato plant gets a bit of maturity on it, it will start making aerial roots towards where it's coming out of the soil, right? Now, so the idea is you plant them down up to the first lot of leaves, and so this trunk is well and truly down in the soil. It's a good idea underneath them. You can put any types of manure or whatever you like to use, but also put some neem tree powder because that will help with the control of insects later on. In a glasshouse situation or outside, put some neem granules on the surface of the soil, which once again will help with the control of whitefly, etc. Your two main problems with tomatoes is traditionally whitefly, and secondly, you've got the psyllid as well. Now, we'll look at the whitefly thing. I found last season that having two glasshouses, I decided that I would have only tomatoes in one, and the other one, which was about 15-20 metres away, I would plant everything else, like the capsicums, cucumbers, etc., etc., based on my thoughts that it's the bloody tomatoes that attract the whitefly, right? And I was right.
Mm.
Because in the other house, I didn't do anything, and I had no whitefly, right? It was magic. In the tomato house, I could, as I have done in the past, use neem granules to create a smell to disguise the smell of the plants. In the old days, we used to plant marigolds in our glass houses and in hanging baskets, and the smell of the marigolds overrode the smell of the tomatoes, and hence the whitefly didn't find the tomato plants and infest them. As a lady had told me from up north, she'd taken our cat repellent, which is naphthalene, like mothballs, same smell as mothballs, and she'd hung it in one of her fruit trees to disguise the tree from that horrible guava moth that they have in the northern region. She said it worked a treat. Didn't have any damage whatsoever to any of my fruit for that season. And I thought, well, okay, it's a stronger smell. So I went to the $2 shop and I got some little ghouls bags, which they use for gift bags, little things they are. And I put some the crystals in that and hung them up from the ceiling in the glass house with my tomatoes. I also hung up yellow sticky pads, which we sell. Now, the yellow sticky pads attract insects, particularly whitefly adults on the wing, and they get stuck to the yellow, and of course that alleviates the amount of damage that they can cause from laying untold eggs. Well, lo and behold, the whole season, I didn't have a white fly in the house whatsoever. I knew that because my sticky yellow traps didn't catch any white fly adults, but it caught some other insects, flying insects, but no white fly. The white fly didn't know my tomatoes were there. And it wasn't until the end of the season, when the naphthalene had finally dissipated out, that I started to get a few white fly coming in. Magic. Totally magic. Now, the same principle, I think, could be utilised outside to a degree. But the problem is, naphthalene is a chemical, so you don't want it to get into the soil. And secondly, it washes away with rain very quickly. So use as a cat repellent, we say, you sprinkle some around, but you also put some inside a container like a milk bottle with the bottoms cut off, so it's sheltered from the rain. And it's 99% effective at keeping cats off your area where you've got your naphthalene. On the basis, I think, that the smell of it is like a great big moggy came through and he marked the territory, and the cat that from next door comes over and goes, oh my God, if he comes back, I'm history. I'm cat meat, right? So it works effectively there. But hanging it up and to do that and to keep it rainproof either in a tree or whatever, if you cut the very bottom off a Coca-Cola bottle, plastic Coca-Cola bottle, right, leaving about an inch, you've got a little umbrella, right? Do you work that one out?
Yeah.
And then you can put a small hole through and a bit of fishing line, catgut or string. You can hang that and you have your little bag sheltered from rain sitting there making a smell. So say on your passion fruit vine, you could hang half a dozen of the damn things. It would cost you hardly anything. And it would disguise the smell of the passion fruit vine and maybe deter the passion hopper, which is a real problem with them. And likewise on other things, maybe outside with your tomato plants, you could hang some of these little bags protected against the weather on the stake next to the plant or whatever, and create a smell, because a lot of insects find where to lay their eggs by the smell of the plant or the fruit, and that's how they get around, particularly ones working at night time. So disguise instead of control. A different approach to gardening. So in the glasshouse, away you go. Now, the psyllid is a problem, because if you've had psyllid problem previous season, and when they get really bad, there's literally thousands of them on the foliage, injecting toxins in, the plant succumbs, it gets all this horrible growth disease up and down the trunks and so forth, and yeah, it just dies in front of your eyes. So For the psyllid in tomatoes, we have a thing called the cell strengthening kit. Now, the cell strengthening kit is three components. You've got a soil drench, which is boron and silica, and you apply that either at planting time or thereabouts to the soil, give each plant a drink, and then again 2 weeks later. You cannot do it more than a couple of times because too much boron, like from borax, causes soil boron toxicity. So a couple of drinks of that, and then you make up the spray, which is the cell strengthening spray with the super spreader. The spreader drives the other one into the plant, and you have that made up in a trigger spray, and you spray the plant every week, the foliage, as it's growing. And later on, when it gets up about a metre high or so, you can drop it back to it every 2 weeks, and then when it's harvesting, drop it back to once a month just for the new foliage to give a bit of protection there. The cells of the plant become so tough that the little psyllids, when they hatch out, they can't pierce the feed and they die very quickly because they're so small. And hence, you've broken the life cycle. It doesn't matter how many million eggs get laid on your plant, none will ever become an adult. And that fixes the problem very nicely. In my situation, I used it when I had a massive problem. I couldn't grow a tomato plant. Basically, they'd only get up to about a metre high and they'd be dying in front of me. And no matter what sprays I use, natural or chemical, didn't make any bloody difference because there's just too many of them. One season using the cell treatment, cleaned up my problem in my backyard totally and completely. The following season, I didn't have to do anything because there's no psyllids anymore. They'd have to come in and reinfest. And one of the problems is, of course, we buy plants from a nursery garden centre, and a lot of those plants are growing up in Auckland, and Auckland's got a lot of psyllids, and we bring them into our home or into our gardens or glasshouse, and we've actually brought the problem in. Same with cabbages and stuff like that. We've got eggs on them from white butterfly. Just have to have a sip of coffee. Voice is going to go.
You're all right. Now, we've got more texts coming in. What we're going to do is hold the questions off. We've got a couple more texts, and we're going to have phones, but we're going to get through the tomatoes and the weed control, and then we'll go back to the questions. How does that sound, Wally?
Yep, no, good to go. So you want me to carry on babbling on?
Yes, of course, but we need to get to finish off the tomatoes too.
Okay, right. So for the psyllids, if you have that problem, use that. The only way you're going to determine is if you grow potatoes and you get the problems there, and you then know you've got psyllid problems in your backyard. Otherwise, get a magnifying glass out, look up on the internet for psyllid, and see what the little nymphs look like so that you can look on the plant. Tamarillos are a subject to them real bad. Pepinos, they affect capsicums, chilies, okra, but to lesser degrees. Tamarillos are worse, tomatoes next, along with potatoes and pepinos. So that's the story for the tomatoes, basically, other than removing laterals and things like that, which people, I have an article that I wrote not so long ago, and anybody can email me to wallyjr@gardennews.co.nz or through the mail order website, and I'm happy to send out articles either every week to them or just the individual ones.
There you go. Weed control.
Okay. Weed control. Okay. Now, you've probably seen that there's other things other than Roundup and herbicides per se that you can use. One very that was popular for a while was pine oil from the pine trees. But any vinegar or oil, cooking oil, etc., you can use as a spray over your weeds. With cooking oils, to make them mix with water, to add some water to them. And once again, you play with the ratios to find what's most effective. Add dishwashing liquid. That acts as an emulsifier, so the oil will actually mix with the water. And then spray the foliage. Now, all of those things have got to be done on a sunny day and when the ground is on the dry side to be most effective, right? In the old days, we used to use change our oil of our old V8s and stuff, and we'd take the oil out, sump oil, and I used to use on playing fields to mark the edges of the field and so forth for the football, etc. So any oil like that, diesel could be used. Diesel's not cheap, but it's not expensive either. But diesel sprayed over the foliage of plants is going to certainly upset them dramatically. Don't use petrol. It's more explosive. But diesel, of course, there's other things too, like flamethrowers that you can buy and you can burn them. I found they weren't really, you had to stand there for ages to try and burn some weeds out. And they're most effective on small, little wee weeds rather than great big ones up to your knee high or whatever. So the idea, of course, with weeds is to get them when they're young. They're most vulnerable and easier to control at that point of time. Now, we do have a compound.
When you do the oil, the water, and the detergent, you said just experiment with the ratios to get it right. What would be a ratio to start with before you start experimenting?
I would probably go to two parts oil, one part water, and a good squirt of dishwashing liquid.
Okay.
And that would be, into a litre of water. So, yeah, it's a matter of playing around. The problem with oils, though, seed oils, I've come to realise, they're really bad for our health. And most of them coming into New Zealand from overseas are actually GE oils. Because I asked one of the supermarkets one time, are your oils like soya oil and so forth, canola, are they GMOs? And they said, we're not going to actually know because they come from overseas. They probably are, but they're not marked. My God.
So seed oils are a disgrace.
Yeah, they're bad for your health, my God, as well. One of the reasons, I suppose, like in the old days, you went to the fish and chip shop and they used lard or fat in their fats. Now they use oil. They don't use that. I have a deep fryer and we only use animal fat, lard, in there. And it gives the beautiful flavour to your chips.
And healthy for you, crazily, because remember they scared us that animal fat was bad for your arteries, all rubbish. And then they make this industrial seed oil. When you read the manufacturing process, you're sick. And the idea that they make it look nice in the supermarket and you buy it thinking it's good for you, nothing could be further from the truth.
That's right. Olive oil is okay.
Olive oil is okay.
So that one's okay. But I wouldn't, sunflower oil, I wouldn't trust that. Any of those.
Your body's never, they've never been in the food system before. They're industrial products. So how effective is diesel oil or oil and water and detergent compared to, say, Roundup?
Well, basically the same.
No way.
Except they don't do the damage. Now, Roundup, if you spray your weeds with Roundup, it takes several days and you start to see them dying off, right? But it's done a lot of damage to your soil at the same time. Likewise, but if you get the conditions right using oil, you you burn the foliage. You literally burn the foliage. It doesn't, unfortunately, affect the root system. So if it's a perennial type weed, it will come again. If it's an annual weed, once it's lost its foliage, its history, it has to reseed to be able to come again. So that's your variant. Anyway, I was going to talk about ammonium sulfamate. Some years ago, a chap from the UK living in New Zealand rang me up and he said to me, can we get ammonium sulfamate in New Zealand? And I said, you mean sulfate of ammonia? He said, no, ammonium sulfamate. I said, okay. I said, why? Never heard of it. What do you do with it? He said, in the UK, we used to be able to get it, and it was crystal powder. You mix it with water, and you sprayed it on the foliage. The foliage thought it was nitrogen. They took it in very readily, and it completely destroyed the foliage. It just destroyed the cells of the plant, right? And I said, really? And I said, you said you used to be able to get it in the UK, and he said, yes, well, it was actually registered for use, but Monsanto kicked up Bobsy Dye because they were losing market share to ammonium sulfamate. So with a bit of arm twisting, they said it had to be banned. And it got banned, my God. Now, in New Zealand, the history of it is railways used to use it on their railway tracks years ago before Roundup, because it's how they used to kill the weeds on the railway tracks.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. So, anyway, as a result of that, I brought some in from China, and I also brought some from India. The China stuff was better than the Indian stuff, and the Indian stuff's all gone now anyway. And I experimented with it. 200 grams was what I learned was the optimum amount per litre of water. So I put that amount into my 16-litre backpack. So that was quite a 16 multiplied by 200, whatever that is. It's about 3 kgs worth, I think. And anyway, I started on one side of the house. It was a lovely sunny day, and the ground was dry. It hadn't rained for a week or two. And I went around spraying the weeds. And I went right around the whole section, back to where I started, and lo and behold, they were dead. That's how cricket worked.
Whoa.
Yeah. It was like paraquat, my God. And paraquat, of course. Hey, paraquat, I've been told, now that because of shedding overseas and crops like whatever they're growing, cotton or whatever, and Roundup Ready plants, which they used to spray to kill the weeds, the plants have shed. And they've shed to the weeds, and the weeds now have become vulnerable, and not vulnerable to Roundup. In other words, they're immune to Roundup. Like the shedding we worried about from the bloody virus and the jabs and stuff like that. That also happened. It's a funny thing in nature with people, a thing called shedding. Anyway, so now they've got a massive problem that they can't control the weeds with Roundup. So now they're adding in paraquat, which has basically been banned everywhere and making the plants, the crop resistant to paraquat. Now that's going into your food chain. So another one to worry about and end your life. Anyway, with the ammonium sulfamate, I found that broadleaf weeds and so forth, you didn't have to do 200 grams. You could come down to 100 grams or 80 grams per litre of water. And small weeds would be killed off very nicely. But the problem, as with Roundup, it doesn't kill the bulbs or the rhizome or the crown of the plant. And it can come away if it's not an annual, being a perennial. So through a situation that happened where a lady rang me up and she wanted to kill the clover in the lawn, and she didn't want to use Roundup, which would not work on clover anyway. And I said, well, use ammonium sulfamate. And I said, just spray the foliage of the clover. And she said, we're going to re-sow the lawn afterwards. And I said, okay. Anyway, she rang me up a month or two later, and she said, we've got a problem. And I said, what's that? She said, we put the lawn seed down, but they won't germinate. I said, well, what did you do? She said, like you said. I said, well, what did you do? And she said, well, I made up the ammonium sulfamate in a watering can, and I watered it over the clover. Oh, my God. I said, spray. She said, no, we watered. I said, did it kill the clover? Oh, yes, it killed the clover, all right, no problems at all. But it's gone down in the soil, and now, when she plants seeds there, of course, it's still working, and it's composting the seeds, so the seeds don't germinate, right? Okay, so say you've got oxalis, deadly little fella, and it's got its foliage up and so forth, so you make up some 200 grams per litre of water, and you water, say, about a cup, say 200-300 mils, over the foliage, down into the soil to compost the bulbs in the soil, right? And if that works a treat, which it should do, that will remove that plant completely. I wouldn't disturb the soil in a hurry, of course, but you could treat all the oxalis like that. It's not going to do any damage to the soil life. Worms just go somewhere else, so they're okay. And you could theoretically get rid of some of those problem weeds, such as that.
What's it called, the product?
It's called ammonium sulfamate. We sell it as compost accelerator, we sell it as super stump rotter, and we also sell it as ammonium sulfamate. And I've got some people out there, landscapers and lifestyle blockers, who buy 25 kg bags off us, and they use that on their weeds. And once again, the conditions should be those ideal ones, sunny and dry on the soil side, to be most effective.
And it's perfectly safe?
Yeah. I've handled it and so forth, no problems at all. I mean, say, anything. Like, say, for instance, sulfate of ammonia, which is a bit similar, but a different form of compound. Like, if you've got a cut in your hand and you put your finger into sulfate of ammonia, you'll sting like hell. So, relatively safe. You wouldn't want to get it in your eyes or anything like that. But you see people out there in their jandals, short trousers, spraying Roundup around like it was going out of fashion. And I think to myself, oh, my God, how stupid is that?
Much better with ammonium sulfamate, because it's tricky, because you get thinking of sulfate of ammonia. Completely different thing, is it?
Yeah. But then again, nitrogen. Now, here's an interesting one. Long before we had chemical herbicides for doing the lawn, we had a product called lawn sand, which you made up yourself. Now, lawn sand was, I can't remember the formula, but it was something like two parts of sand to one part ammonium sulfamate, ammonium sulfate, right, which is nitrogen, right? And you broadcast that over your lawn. Now, what happened is the nitrogen, of course, burns the weeds. It singes the grass a little bit, as if you're using lawn fertilizer and you put it on too heavily, you'll burn the grass because it's got ammonia, sulfate of ammonia in it. But that grass will recover, of course, no problems at all, and the weeds don't. So lawn sand is the old way of weeding lawns in days gone by.
Amazing. Okay. And now, we're going to try this, listeners, so we need your patience. And we need you to give it a go. So give us a call, 0800 20 57 57. 0800 20 57 57. You can send a text, but that's sort of not as much fun. You can text us at 2057, but give us a call at 0800 20 57 57, and we'll get you talking to Wally live. But first up, here's a tough one for you, Wally. What's eating my pahutukawa? The leaves are full of holes. From Michelle. Got a clue there, Wally?
On the pahutukawa?
Yes.
Right, okay. Well, obviously, if they don't see a caterpillar or anything on the plant, it's beetles at night. And you need to go out with a torch after dusk and have a wee look. And you may be surprised. Now, this time of the year, it could be early influxation of grass grub beetles because they'll be starting to emerge. Now things are starting to settle down a bit. And in some cases, particularly with that little pesty, there can be hundreds, literally hundreds, on a plant, all having a little nosh up at night.
Mm.
Now, if that's the case, pyrethrum. We've got Wally's Super Pyrethrum there, which is only used at 1 mL to 2 litres of water. My God, it's so potent. You mix that up and you go out there with your torch and your spray bottle and you see the beetles and you give them a spray where they are. Now, like fly spray, that they get a dose of that, fix the nervous system, and they die. Yep.
That's your food account.
So that's what I would do in that regard.
Now we've got a caller. Good morning, Ben. You're our number one caller with Wally. Have we got you, Ben?
That'll be me, is it?
Yes, it's you, Ben. Ben.
Dean. It's Dean.
Oh, calling. Dean. I'm sorry, Dean.
No, that's okay. Hey. That's okay. Good as gold. Hey, loving the show. I'm a bit of a home gardener myself, and I've got a number of questions.
There you go,
don't
Wally.
Have to answer all of them.
Yep.
You might have some other callers coming through, but... first up, Wally, do you have a shop? You talk about Wally's product. Is that a shop you have, or
mail order? Well, it's mainly the products are sold by mail order or through Mitre 10, through garden centres. No shop in New Zealand stock all my products. We do have a shop in Martin here, but in actual fact, it's a Filipino food shop. But some people do come here and buy some of the gardening products, but it's mostly the shop is dedicated to Asian foods.
I see. So, but it's mail order. So if we were to order anything from you, like your cell treatment kit, for example, is that through mail order?
Yep, through the 0800 website. So you can order there, then I have a chat to you when I get the order.
Okay, lovely, awesome. Righto, tomato question. Powdery mildew, what do I do about that? In my hot house, it's a big problem every year.
Right, okay. And it's relative to a time of the year, usually autumn and so forth. It's at that point of time, either outside or in the glass house, it's telling you the season is coming to an end. But unfortunately, it ends a bit quicker than it could do. There's two things you can do. I found the most simplest is I spray with our neem tree oil, diluted down to 5 mL per litre. Spray that over the foliage. It immediately goes back to green, right? So the plant can photosynthesize again. You can use a spray of baking soda. A tablespoon of baking soda to a litre of water, but you've got to be careful. Sometimes with some plants, they're a bit alkaline sensitive, and you could do damage rather than that. But normally speaking, baking soda is a preventative for black spot and also for powdery mildew. And if you use it with rain guard so it doesn't wash off, it works better. But neem oil turns them back to green quickly.
Okay, fantastic. I'll have to look in a little bit more about my tomatoes because I get sort of a black going up the stem, which then goes through into the leaf. So that sort of black kind of mouldy look, would that
that's powdery mildew? That's
the solid damage.
Yep.
Okay. because I've been using the baking soda and what have you, and I just hadn't got on top of it, and then my plants died, and I just assumed it was powdery mildew, but that's the facilit.
That's the solid, and there's a bacteria that happens as a result of it, which causes that fungi-like stuff up and down the trunk, and the plant dies.
Yes, it does. Yep. Okay, right. Change of thought. Thank you. That's fantastic. That's good to know. Now, one other issue that I have is I grow elephant garlic. And it just grows like a trooper, no problem at all. This year, I bought some from an organic garlic grower, five different varieties of garlic, and planted them all, and rust.
The garlic rust. Already the season, my God.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Garlic rust. We've yet to find the perfect solution to prevent it and control it. We have tried sprays of potassium permanganate. We've tried sprays of sulfur. We've tried sprays of copper. We've tried sprays with all of them together. We've tried the copper nutrient, which works from inside the plant. Once it takes hold, and one of the problems that I discovered myself was that the cloves that we bring in, or the bulbs, and then we break them up and plant the cloves, may have the spores of the rust already there. So this last season, in winter time, I soaked all my cloves prior to planting for a few hours in a solution of potassium permanganate to kill any possible spores. The best aspect is the problem, because the foliage, part or a lot of the foliage, has rust, that leaf cannot photosynthesize and get energy from the sun. So that's where the crutch of the matter is. So what we have to do is use liquid sunshine. Now, liquid sunshine is very simply a tablespoon of molasses dissolved in a litre of hot water, and when it cools, put it into the sprayer and spray the foliage of the plants regularly. And when I say regularly, you have it made up sitting next to where they're growing. You walk past, pick it up, spray, and maybe do it every day, every second day, and so forth. What we're doing is we're bypassing the sunlight problem and getting as much carbs into the foliage as possible. We can even water some into the soil as well. And people that have used that method have told me that they have got a reasonable-sized bulb as a result, instead of getting nothing of any consequence.
Oh, really? Now, what was that again? That was one
tablespoon of molasses to a litre of hot water to dissolve it nicely, and then cooled. Now, I would also add the magic botanic liquid to that, which is a growth stimulator as well, and spray them regularly with that. Now, the problem if you put magic botanic liquid with the molasses, the magic botanic liquid, being natural, is likely to have microbes in it. And if you leave the container sealed, it will start to balloon up as the microbes are growing. And so in your sprayer, you just open it up so you allow the air for any residue or any product that you've got left in them. Because I had a lady, she rang me up and she complained that she had it all there and it was using trigger sprayers she bought from us. She said they leaked. I said, they can't leak. I said, and I found out what she'd done. She'd made up the molasses and the magic botanic liquid. And, of course, it was forcing out of the sprayer. And she lost it because as the microbes built.
Okay, Dean, how was that?
That was a wealth of information, and really appreciate it. Now, your number again, what was the phone number you said? 0800?
466. 0800 466 464. And the same for the website with www in front and .co.nz at the end. Now, the interesting thing with my liquid sunshine is that because of those naughty chemtrails and the naughty hazy skies and so forth, plants are not growing like they used to. And a lot of gardeners are telling me, things just don't grow like they used to. And I say, well, no, because they're not getting so much direct sunlight from nice blue, clear blue skies. Even I look at the skies these days, and it's a murky blue. It's not a clear blue anymore. And that's affecting the plants, and also the reduced CO2 levels because of the rubbishy thing about it's going to save the planet. It's so funny. It's not even funny.
There you go.
Global warming.
There you go, Dean.
So the molasses is going to help. That's to help with the photosynthesis. That's, there we go.
Yep.
Offset the cloud.
No, there you go, Dean.
Much appreciated. Really appreciate it.
Dean, I appreciate your call. You were our first caller to go live. Thank you so much. Kevin, we've got Kevin. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning to you both. A silly question, Wally, if I may. Can you hear me? I'm talking through a headset.
You got him, Wally?
Yeah.
Hello, it's Kevin speaking. Can you hear me? I'm talking to you through a headset.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yep, okay. Sorry, a silly question. I have a little citrus orchard where I live in rural Chipuki. I'm about 350 metres up, and all of my fruit trees are the same. It's very difficult for them to set fruit. My plum trees have just finished, of which I have two, not a plum. And even my apples, it's very difficult to set fruit.
Okay, do you have pollinators, bees working?
Yeah, I have pollinators, I have bees next door. I live rurally, I'm out of the orchard belt, no sprays.
Okay, so you have seen the bees working the plants, working the flowers?
Well, I must admit I haven't stood there and looked. The beehives are probably 300 metres away.
Yes.
Because I normally work from daylight to dusk.
Yeah. Bees are an interesting little fella. It depends what they've got available. And if they've got a paddock of clover over the way, they'll all be over there and leaving your trees alone. They've got to be attracted to the trees. So, once again, if you made up a solution of sugar and water and so forth, something to encourage them, even put a little bit of honey in there, but that's not good for the bees in case the honey is contaminated with some virus or whatever. But sugar is quite safe.
Okay.
That's what beekeepers use, and spray the trees to try and attract some bees. If the bees are not working the flowers, it's not going to happen.
No.
Now, in the old days, we used to have fruit set, which was a hormone which you could spray over the flowers to set the fruit. You could try hand pollinating a little bit. That would prove whether it's pollinators not working the tree if the fruit or the flowers that you hand pollinate and keep a note of which ones they are, tie a bit of wool or something to that branch and run a fine brush through the flowers and so forth to move the pollen from one to the other. The other aspect is if they are getting pollinated but it's not setting fruit, maybe insufficient potash, and we have a product called Fruit and Flower Power, which makes quite a bit of difference to setting fruit and better flavour.
Okay, yeah, I did wonder if it was something like a nutrient thing, because it is a very high rainfall area, and I'm wondering if the nutrients are just getting washed away.
High rainfall, I find, in spring, with fruit trees, you get a magnificent crop, because I don't think we water our fruit trees enough while the fruit is developing. And when you have a wet period, you have a magnificent crop because I get in lots of water from lots of rain. So just a little tip too that maybe in a period of time while the fruit are forming and growing and maturing, keep the trees well watered.
There you go, Kevin. Okay. How was that?
Thank you very much. I shall observe the bees, apply some potash, and keep an eye on the water after fruit set.
There you go, and put some honey, put some sugar and water out. There you go, Kevin. Great work. Now, just I've got Kayleen on the line, but we'll get to you after Wally. I've just got a couple of texts. Someone says, what's the weed spray? What's it called? It's called ammonium sulfamate. That correct, Wally?
Yep, sulfamate, yes.
Can you mix this chemical with chili solution? I've used this chili solution to some great effect on my pathway weeds.
With chili solution? Yeah, okay. I've never heard of that before. But
oh,
yeah,
there you go.
Pathway weeds, I tend to say just go and get yourself a bag of salt and sprinkle that thickly over the cracks or wherever the weeds are. That takes them out. And it's quite a cheap method to use as well.
How do I get rid of white butterfly?
How do you get rid of them? Well, you can't get rid of them, but you have to protect your plants or control. I find crop cover is the best thing in regards to white butterfly, where you have the crop cover over the plants and then you have some alkathene pipe, rigid alkathene pipe, as hoops. So the plants are protected from birds, cats, and white butterfly can't get to them to lay the eggs.
There you go.
That's the best solution. There is an alternative. If you use a neem granules, neem powder, you tend to find that the white butterflies will lay the eggs on the outer leaves, and the little caterpillars hatch out, and they take a bite of the leaf, make a little hole, and then they die because there's already neem from the neem granules on the ground. It's got into the plant and they stop eating. And that can work quite well too.
Mm. Well, last question, Wally. You've been a big in demand. Does Wally have a trick to keep flies out of the house? It's from Joe.
we do have these fly bags on the website which you hang outside, and there's a smell which attracts them, and they die in the solution of this stuff. You do that. If you create, and this is a rude one, if you want to keep the flies out of the kitchen, do a poo in the lounge.
There you go, Wally. Well, yeah, I think we've better stop.
If there's a smell outside, once again, flies are attracted by smell, and so you're cooking something or whatever, and they fly in. Besides that, inside is the warmth, which if it's a bit chilly outside, they prefer because they're cold-blooded. Mm. But these fly bags are quite effective. And then I see too back. Remember the old days? You used to have these things. It used to be DDT, but now they use something else because DDT is banned. But the yellow things that uncoil and hang from the ceiling, and they're sticky, and the flies are attracted to them, and they look bloody horrible, but they catch a lot of flies.
Mm.
Yeah.
There you go, Wally, our gardening guru. It's so good to talk to you. So good to have you back. I'm sorry, we've got to set it up that I can see you. I miss seeing you.
You can see me.
Mm, I can't see you.
Yeah, well, I miss your charming face.
Yes. There you go, Wally.
I'm staring at my computer without you.
There you go. We will have you back. That was Wally. You're on Real Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde.
The RCR Shop has great gift ideas. From great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR Shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.